Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I am Joe McCormick. And on today's episode of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, we're going to be doing one of our invention episodes where we look at an invention from history, look at what came before, what this invention changed, how it works. And Rob, the subject you have picked for today's series is the crossbow. Now, I have to ask, is there a Dungeons and Dragons related origin story to you wanting to cover this?
I mean, pretty much.
I think there often is with you. I feel like I can tell when it's coming.
Yeah, because the crossbow, of course, is all over Dungeons and Dragons. I've definitely role-played characters that had crossbows. But the thing that's always fascinated me about crossbows and role-playing games is the way they're depicted. Because a lot of times they do end up just becoming guns. You know, they're like blasters that shoot crossbow bolts. And in a lot of games, you don't put a lot of emphasis on the device itself and how it's working and any kind of like realistic idea about how it's loaded and reloaded. In Dungeons and Dragons, that's the way it tends to go. Like, you can just fire your crossbow every turn. It's no big deal.
Yeah.
But years back, my gaming group did another role-playing game. And this one is one that was tied in with Dragon Age, I believe. And my memory may be crossed on some of these things here and there because it was like a good 10 years ago at this point. But if memory serves, the crossbow mechanics in that game were perhaps a little more accurate to a lot of crossbow technology and some of the examples we'll discuss here. But it was also decidedly unfun. Because it was one of these situations where I often go into gaming, role-playing gaming, sort of like imagination first, rule second. Like, I'll make choices that may come back to bite me in the butt because I didn't think about how the rules would impact my choices. And this was definitely a case like that, because I decided I was going to be a dwarf. I was going to have this cool crossbow. But said crossbow, as it turns out, had to be reloaded for an entire turn after use. So we get into a battle. And my dwarf would fire this crossbow, you know, probably miss. And then the next turn, he's just, I don't know, cranking this sucker, or, you know, he has it on the ground, like redrawing the bow of the crossbow, and then gets to fire and miss on the following turn.
Now, that might not be more fun, but that is more accurate, because one of the big changes you see across the history of crossbows is not so much changes to the basic design of the crossbow itself, but spanning mechanisms for how you load and draw the string and lock it into place. So, yeah, I can imagine D&D would be a lot more cumbersome if, you know, your rogue had to get out a craniquin every single time to crank the crossbow back and sitting there like trying to wind it up.
Yeah, it can get tedious, which is, I think, is why in Dungeons and Dragons you tend to find the crossbow just fires each turn, and it's just assumed that you are you have enough skill to make it happen. I don't know. There's probably some sort of way you could make make the mechanics of it more engaging, but I think probably just firing at each turn is the best way to go.
Well, and some of the loading or spanning mechanisms do appear to have been faster than others in history. So not all of them had like a windlass or a crannequin, one of these big cranking mechanisms. There were also mechanisms where you just have like a stirrup that you put your foot in, then you pull it back, and that works pretty quick.
Yeah, assuming you have firm ground underfoot. I ran across mention of an ancient Chinese text that was warning against using crossbows if you were on like damp ground, and which makes sense. Like suddenly you have your crossbowmen out there. They need a reload, but you have trouble either getting your foot down into it, or it may be a situation where you need to lie on your back and then stretch it against your feet. And that could also might or might not work depending on how muddy the terrain is.
Yeah, you could imagine that. And I guess you would probably need stable footing, even though the stirrup method, you're pulling against yourself. You might have like a hook on your belt or something to pull the mechanism back while you push in the stirrup with your foot. But then you'd probably need to have the other foot on stable ground.
Yeah. But, you know, I think all this is kind of the appeal of the crossbow is like an idea. We were talking before we came in to record here how, for my own part, growing up in Tennessee, being in Boy Scouts, you had the opportunity to fire rifles on shooting ranges. You got the opportunity to fire, to use bow and arrow on archery ranges. But I never had the chance to try out a crossbow. And so the crossbow was always this kind of like mysterious thing in between. And yet, unlike a gun, you could still look at it. And even as a kid, understand like the basic principles of how it worked.
Well, yeah, because with a crossbow, I mean, just like with a bow, there can be a lot of different design elements that could improve features of how it works, improve usability, improve the energy delivered or the draw length or whatever, the speed of the projectile. But still, at core, a crossbow operates on the same principle as a bow.
Yeah. And of course, yeah, to discuss the crossbow, we're going to have to talk a little bit about the bow at least. And there, it's not just a situation where, well, we had the bow and then we created the crossbow and we just threw all those bows away. It's not nearly as simple as that. And we'll discuss some of the famous examples of crossbows going up against bows and how that played out. But the oldest evidence for the bow and arrow, as cited by Brian M. Fagan and Peter Rowley Conway in the 70 Great Inventions of the Ancient World, goes back 10,000 years to the early Mesolithic period in Denmark. This is 1,000 years later than the earliest evidence of arrows, 12,000 years ago in what is now Germany. And stone arrowheads date back 18,000 to 20,000 years ago in Spain, and possibly have arrow points from 60 to 70,000 years ago in South Africa. The problem with ancient bows, of course, is that they were almost always made of organic materials that just do not survive the test of time, with the actual arrowheads being the most long-lasting part of the combined weapon technology.
Right, so you'll find evidence of arrowheads going back longer than clear evidence of the bows themselves. And I think that example you mentioned from South Africa, like the Sibudu Cave, is one of the earliest I've read about, but that's arrowhead evidence.
Right. So no, absolutely nobody that I've come across is making any argument that crossbows go back nearly that far. I think it's clear, there's clear indication that the bow came first, of course. But it is also, worth noting that even with things like the crossbow is still made out of mostly organic materials, with the main differences being, okay, you have, of course, the head of the bolt, which may be made out of a metal of some sort. And then, as we'll discuss later on, you also have the lock of a crossbow. This is the implement that holds back the drawn string. And so when this is made out of metal, we may find evidence of it, such as bronze crossbow locks from China. Now, on the show before, we've talked a bit about the history of projectile weapons. Particularly, I think most recently, we did a series of episodes on animals throwing things, and then we did one on humans throwing things. And that was really interesting because you got into a lot of of situations where you're not just throwing any rock, you're throwing specially prepared rocks, or you're throwing things like hunting sticks at animals, that sort of thing.
Yeah, you can have modifications of the projectiles themselves. But in terms of launching technology, we actually did a whole other invention episode back when we had a separate invention podcast on the Odolotl, which was a piece of launching technology that was essentially a lever arm to get increased leverage on a spear.
So these various non-bow and pre-bow missile weapon technologies, these had a huge impact on the world of hunter-gatherers. You know, extended the range of human violence beyond physical human reach. And by the time the bow comes along and starts spreading, this just extends the range even farther. And of course, it all served to extend human dominance over animals and other hominids, as well as transforming conflict between humans. Now, one of the basics about the bow and arrow, and this is something that, you know, is obvious, I think, by watching it in action, is that, as Fagan and Raleigh Conway point out, the bow is essentially a spring that stores energy when the bowstring is drawn. Then when the string is released, that energy is transferred into the propulsion of the arrow. Different types of wood provided different advantages, and eventually compound bows made use of multiple parts to provide maximized performance.
Yes, it is worth noting that despite the different form and the different way you hold these weapons, a bow and a crossbow both typically work on the same mechanical principle, which is the principle of the spring. By storing energy in the form of elastic potential and then releasing that potential suddenly to propel an arrow in the case of a bow or a bolt in the case of a crossbow at high speed. Now, when you shoot a bow, there's actually a common misconception that the energy comes from stretching the bow string. Even though I know better, I think sometimes my brain still wants to think this way. But the string of a bow really doesn't stretch very much at all. So that's not where the energy is coming from. The energy comes from bending the bow itself, bending the limbs of the bow. And when you pull the string, it bends the bow. When you release the string, the bow returns to its original shape, and it propels the arrow as it does so because it is pulling the string taut. So the string is sort of a medium. It's how you pull the bow back, and how the snapping back energy of the bow is delivered to the arrow.
This is why Legolas says, "And my bow, and not and my string."
That's right. Now, if you've never actually shot a bow at a target, you might be shocked how much strength it takes to draw back a bow. You know, I've done this at various points in my life. Most recently, several years back, I did a goofy little archery range at a Renaissance festival. And even in that setting, I remember being shocked at how difficult it was to pull back the bow, and surprised at how aiming the bow was made so much more difficult than it looks because of the tension when you're holding a drawn bow. So you're flexing, you know, maybe as hard as you can when you pull a bow string back. And that intense exertion makes it harder to aim your shot. Your arm might want to tremble. You're straining with your whole body. You're also putting a lot of strain on your hand and your fingers that are holding the bowstring back. Mm-hmm. So imagine trying to aim something precisely while you're in the middle of a bench press or some other weight lift. And so it's easy to see how a crossbow really changes the game there. A crossbow allows the tension of the bow to be locked in place and then released by an external mechanism instead of being drawn, held, and released purely by the strength of your muscles and bones.
That's right. And this is where the genius of the crossbow comes in, because the crossbow, I mean, you can almost think of the crossbow as like a robotic or technological replacement for the arm or the arms in this scenario, because once the bow is drawn back, this trigger or lock holds everything in place, holds all of that potential power in place, and then it can be released by pulling a trigger.
And this is a point I actually saw emphasized by the author of a book I'm going to mention at some point in this series, that a big difference between, say, somebody who was a skilled archer with a longbow versus somebody who was a skilled crossbow operator in the medieval period, say, a big difference would be the level of fitness required. In order to be a longbow operator, there is just like way more requirement of real upper body strength and training of physical training, not just skill training.
Yeah, there's a lot of skill involved with the use of a bow. And I should highlight there are going to be differences depending on where and how a bow is utilized for what specific hunting or military uses and so forth. I mean, for example, there's a difference between the skill of a bowman on foot and a mounted archer out there in a battle scenario. But one of the primary examples of archery expertise that I'm going to mention here and also pops up in a lot of the literature is, of course, the archers who use the English longbow. This was a powerful bow that required a considerable amount of upper body strength, and you had to work for years to build up the strength to use these weapons, and generally had to start at a very early age. More on the English longbow in a minute here, but one of the key factors to consider in all this is draw weight. None of this will come as a shock to any bow hunters out there for sure, and maybe you can write in and tell us a few things about all of this, but the idea is that pulling back on a, say, 60-pound draw weight bow would be like lifting a 60-pound weight off the ground. But then, of course, as we've been discussing, it's not just lifting that 60-pound weight. It's holding it, aiming it, perhaps with your life on the line in a military scenario, and then releasing it.
Yeah, trying to finally control both aim and timing while you are holding back this extremely heavy weight.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. A-S-T-E-P-R-O allergy.com. Astapro and go. Use this directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Now, regarding the basic physics of a bow draw, I was looking around on this, and one great source I came across was actually an old school How Stuff Works article. takes me back.
Yeah. Yeah. Who wrote this one?
One by our friend Tracy Wilson, now host of Stuff You Missed in History Class.
Oh, nice.
But Tracy's article on how the crossbow works goes into several of the main variables that determine the energy of a bow shot. So as you were just saying, there is what's called a bow's draw weight. And this is the force it takes to draw the bow. And this depends on multiple things like the material properties of the bow material, on the size of the bow, its shape and design, and so forth. There is also the draw length, which is the distance between the bowstring's resting position and the point that you draw it back to. And of course, draw length is not an intrinsic property of the bow, but changes with each draw. Like you could draw it back to different lengths. And so it would be a characteristic of a bow shot. Also, generally, the draw weight increases along with the draw length. So the farther you pull the bowstring back, the more force it takes. So you might say that a bow has a certain draw weight at a certain draw length. Hmm.
Because even with, say, an English longbow, a child would be able to pick it up and pull back pull the bow back a little bit, but yeah, not enough to actually get to the full draw and the full potential of the bow.
Yes, and this actually comes back to questions medieval history nerds like to ask, like, you know, how much strength does it take to shoot an English longbow of the 13th century or something? And you could say, well, you know, if the bow is made like this, it would take this much strength to shoot it at its full potential, you know, with this amount of draw length. But probably anybody could underdraw the bow. So it's just a question of like how effective you are at using it.
Yeah.
But regarding these variables, draw weight and draw length, they can affect the shot in various ways. For example, the longer the draw length in terms of distance, the longer in terms of time the string will be pushing the arrow before it is released. Does that make sense? So that imparts more energy. If you pull it actually farther back, the string is pushing the arrow and giving it force longer. And so the energy stored for a bow shot can be calculated as roughly draw weight times draw length divided by two. And then the energy of the shot would be measured in units like foot pounds, you know, the energy required to lift 1 pound by 1 foot, or joules. So the design of a bow can make a big difference in the energy it can deliver. A long bow with a longer draw length and a heavier draw weight tends to impart more energy to the arrow and thus increase its range. A long bow can shoot over longer distances and tend to shoot heavier arrows. But materials matter. Traditionally, bows were made out of strong and elastic woods. You know, in the case of the English longbow, the wood of the yew tree is often mentioned. But modern bows are often made of different materials and parts designed to flex and store energy in different ways. Often not just one piece of wood anymore, but different kinds of materials. And there is also a difference that's important to remember between compound bows and composite bows. You can mix them up because they both start with COM, but composite bows are regular bows made out of a combination of different materials, often laminated together. So traditionally by combining wood with different types of animal parts like horn and sinew, whereas compound bows are bows that use different parts such as pulleys or other levering machines to give the archer mechanical advantage in drawing back to allow maybe for more rigid bow material to be used.
So it's composite materials and then compounded force.
Right. Compound bows have machines in them, like pulleys or levers. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think everyone's probably seen this, especially it's kind of like an almost iconic of modern, say, bow hunters. You'll see those various pulleys on the bow.
And so all of these mechanical principles basically apply to crossbows as well, though there are some common design differences that you would observe with crossbows, even though they're not necessary to the principle of a crossbow. For example, crossbows typically have shorter limbs than longbows, and also shorter bolts, so a shorter draw length, though that's not fundamental to what a crossbow is. It just happens to be that crossbows are usually like that.
Now, one source I was looking at for different stats on draw strength was a website called bowhunting.com, which points out that modern compound bows are pretty excellent. They say you can comfortably hunt with a 40-pound draw bow, and that's perfectly reasonable for most hunting scenarios with big game. I'm assuming they're mostly talking about something like a deer in this case. They specify 60 to 65 for something like a moose or an elk. And they point out that some shooters today can handle 70, 80, or 90-pound bows. So this brings us to the question, all right, well, we're talking about the English longbow is sort of the bow par excellence. Well, what kind of draw are we talking about on those? Well, as it turns out, it's a matter of some debate, but the best U English longbows may have required, and I stress may, it depends on who's crunching the figures here, but it may have required between 150 and 180-pound draws. That's 81.6 kilograms on the upper end.
And even if it's not that high, I mean, a over 100-pound draw, which I think is widely agreed upon, that's still incredibly, yeah, that is, it's hard to imagine.
And like we've been saying, it would not only be, a test of strength to draw that bow, to aim and then release it just a single time. You have to remember that, especially in a warfare situation, the archer would be firing over and over again. Repetition is key. Even in a hunting scenario, according to bowhunting.com, the rule of thumb is that whatever weight you're using on your bow, you need to be able to do it 30 times in a row without feeling fatigued.
That's a lot of reps.
Yeah, I don't think that means that you're necessarily firing 30 arrows at a single deer, but I think that's the general idea is if you can't do that, then you need to cut back on your draw strength.
I hesitate to speculate because I know nothing about bow hunting, but I imagine that would be about trying to aim and time the correct shot. So you might be drawing in cases where you wouldn't actually be releasing the arrow.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, not every time you draw back are you actually going to fire that arrow. So the English longbow was the ultimate missile weapon during the Hundred Years' War and saw use into the 16th century. It played an important role in multiple battles. We'll get to one in a minute, but another one is the Battle of Agincourt from 1415, in which the English forces famously focused, I think, 80% of their battle force on ranged weapons to secure victory. In this and other examples, we should point out, like, it's not as important as the weaponry choice is. It's not the only factor, of course. There are other factors involved in any given warfare scenario. The bows may not survive all that well, as we've discussed, but skeletons do. And while this is apparently also not a 100% agreed upon issue, you do have this situation where in 1982, the wreck of the Mary Rose was raised. This is a ship that sank, English ship that sank in 1554. And the skeletons on board displayed a disproportionate amount of a shoulder ossification condition known as OS acromiale. This is actually associated with elite archery. So, repeatedly drawing back on some sort of a powerful bow, for example. And there were longbows on board. It's not 100%, again, but it's an often cited correlation when it comes to just like talking about like what sort of physical prowess would be required to use these bows efficiently in a warfare scenario.
So the point being that both the longbow and the crossbow could be highly effective in various scenarios for hunting or for warfare or whatever, but the longbow required incredible physical strength and intense physical training, whereas the crossbow did require some skill training. You had to know how to use it, but did not place the same kind of demands on the human body.
Right. And even in cases where you didn't have any kind of a pulley system, et cetera, to aid you in drawing the crossbow, you at least did not have to do any kind of precision aiming while doing it. All you had to worry about was getting it drawn back all the way, and then the lock would come into place, and then you can aim without having to endure that physical strain. So yeah, as Fagan and Rowley Conway point out, yeah, the crossbow can be kept drawn for much longer than an archer can possibly hold a drawn bow. And the crossbow can be made even more powerful than the strongest bow. But I have to stress on this, as we'll discuss, I mean, this all comes down to scale, right? I mean, and range. There are a number of factors involved there because any given crossbow is not necessarily more powerful than a bow, as we'll discuss. But yeah, one of the key advantages here is that it kind of democratizes the use of a bow weapon. While a bow's power is limited by the strength of the archer A crossbow can, again, be drawn via mechanical devices. So you can end up with a weapon that ensures greater accuracy, at least at short to medium ranges, with less specialized training required. The downside, of course, as we already alluded to, is that actually drawing the crossbow tends to take more time than drawing a bow. Again, if on one side you have somebody who can effectively draw the longbow that they're using, and on the other side you have someone who has a nice crossbow, and this is especially true if you're having to employ some sort of mechanical apparatus to draw the crossbow, but it also seems true if you're having to do something like, you know, stick it in the ground and then draw back using your arms and your legs.
One other difference in the calculation I have come across is the idea that crossbow equipment would generally be more expensive than longbow equipment.
That's a good point, too. So the more gears and so forth that are involved, it may make it easier for everyone to use it, but it becomes a more specialized technology as well. Now, another important battle to touch on is another scenario involving the English longbow, and that's the Battle of Crecy from 1346, in which the technology of the English longbow ensured victory over French crossbowmen. And I was reading about this in the book Connections by James Burke, who we've brought him up on the show before. And I think fairly recently somebody wrote in about James Burke's work on our listener mail episodes.
Yeah.
But Burke points out that the English longbow had exceptional range. He cites 400 yards and special steel arrowheads that were designed to punch through armor at close range. And he points out that an experienced archer could loose 9 arrows in a minute, while the French crossbowmen required lengthier reload time. So the idea is, like, the archers have fired, the crossbowmen fire, and then before the crossbowmen can reload their weapons, the archers have fired again. However, the experienced archer part of the scenario is key once more. Burke writes that within decades of this pivotal battle that saw the championing of the English longbow over crossbows and traditional armored knights, it was, after this, 10 years later, increasingly impossible to find enough skilled archers to power the longbow and provide the sort of overwhelming firepower that ruled the day at Crecy. Burke discusses the possible reasons for this at length in the book, and I believe in, the documentary TV series as well. And he cites a number of different reasons, entailing the continued recovery from the plague, improvements in plowing technology, various other inventions and innovations, improved diets, and also a general improvement in the quality of life for the average human. Burke writes, quote, "It took years for a man to be trained to use the 6-foot yew bow. And here was the adult male population frittering away valuable training hours, enjoying itself. The reason, therefore, that the longbow enjoyed such a brief spell of success lay in the rising standard of living, which the agricultural revolution had brought about."
Although, interestingly, I was reading a historical fact about how the introduction of widespread crossbow use did not eliminate this tension between sort of like free time and enjoyment and the military leader's emphasis that everybody really should be training. So there's a book I've been looking at called The Medieval Crossbow by Stuart Ellis Gorman, published in the year 2022, Pen and Sword Military Press. And this is a book-length investigation of the crossbow. And I was reading a Reddit AMA with this author who points out that you have multiple ordinances from the government in various places throughout medieval Europe, in England, but also in late medieval France, and at some point in Genoa, that were like banning leisure activities and telling people to be doing archery or crossbow practice instead. So like Genoa at some point banned tournaments and banned gambling and said you should be practicing your crossbow instead of doing these things.
Yeah, it's like the Conan the Barbarian principle. You know, you watch Conan the Barbarian, it's like, yeah, he's a great warrior, but man, he seems miserable. He's not really making any time or is given any time to do anything else. So, you know, of course he's this mighty warrior. But as it becomes less, as people begin to have other choices in their life, they're not just constantly practicing those archery skills. And therefore, you can see the shift perhaps being made to something like the crossbow, that is usable by the average person, but without all of this extensive training.
Though as this shows, it wouldn't require the same level of physical training, but you would still have to practice.
Yeah, yeah. You couldn't just hand them out and expect everyone to just automatically hit everything you're aiming at. Though I guess there's room in that statement for various arguments about what sort of scale are you handing them out at. And certainly, as we may discuss in this episode and the next, I mean, there are examples where a lot of crossbows are deployed in given battles in different scenarios.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Today I'm going to give you some straightforward advice on how to deal with naughty kids. How about instead of timeouts, time ins? Time for you to start paying some bills. I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward. Inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
Now, this leads us to the question, of course, when do we see the earliest crossbows? And, of course, one of the issues, again, in dating earliest crossbows, of course, are the organic materials that aren't going to survive the test of time, and you're having to rely on things like crossbow bolt heads and then also the locks. But another interesting point that's brought up by Fagan and Rowley Conway is that sometimes it's difficult to say what's a crossbow and what's a catapult. They point out that the earliest crossbows in some regions anyway kind of resembled small catapults, and there was likely, they think, some sort of transformative step from stationary to mobile weaponry here. And I can kind of imagine this is kind of like, you can imagine people thinking, what if we made a bigger bow? Well, we wouldn't be able to pull that back. We'd have to do something else. And then they're like, okay, I've created it. And what have you created? It's kind of like a cross. It's kind of like a big crossbow. It's kind of also like a catapult. And then you might think, this is interesting. What if we scale this back down? And then you could hold it.
Yes, though, I do think scale does tend to place different requirements on like what kinds of mechanisms you can use. For example, you can look at the ballista, which is like a siege weapon, which has existed since ancient times, and say, well, that looks a lot like a crossbow, but it does have a different mechanism for storing energy than the crossbow does. The crossbow stores it in the tension of the bow of the limbs, whereas I can't remember exactly what the mechanism is for the ballista, but it's different. I think it has to do with like winding ropes or something.
Yeah, so catapults we might have to come back to and other siege equipment because there's a lot of interesting innovation that goes on there. Apparently biblical accounts point back to the reign of Uzziah around 800 BCE as a possible time during which people were using catapults, and then there's a definite mention of them in Sicily around 400 BCE. But of course, all of this stems from, you know, ancient world scenarios in which you had walled city states encountering siege situations. And of course, the besiegers would have to devise various ways to have to contend with this. And of course, the besieged on their end would come up with various means of defending themselves. So Fagan and Rowley Conway point to two key dates for earliest crossbow emergence. One in 2nd century BCE Rome, which we'll come back to in a bit, and the other in 5th century BCE China. Now, you can well ask, were these independent advances? Perhaps it's also been theorized by many that the Chinese invention simply spread to the West, perhaps more than once. And we can't necessarily connect all the dots here, but you can point out the key dots and some of the time periods that are associated with them.
Yeah, so you don't know exactly how it traveled, though it does seem to me uncontroversially agreed upon that the earliest crossbow usage was in ancient China.
Yes. So the 5th century BCE dating, I believe, concerns bronze crossbow components, bronze bolt heads, bronze crossbow locks, and these have been dated to the mid-7th century BCE. Bolts have also turned up in Chinese tombs from this time period. John Key, in his book on Chinese history, writes that the crossbow was long, quote, the weapon of first choice in the Chinese military, but advancements in equestrian power did end up limiting its effectiveness somewhat. So these would not so much be the fact that people were riding the horses, but people were armored on the horse. The horse and the strength of the horse and the speed of the horse were able to convey an armored individual around more easily. But of course, this comes a good bit later.
But it's not just artifacts, right? Because I think ancient Chinese texts do make explicit mention of the crossbow.
Yeah, Sun Tzu in The Art of War from the 5th century BCE definitely mentions them, brings up like sort of philosophically, right? That he says, quote, energy may be likened to the bending of a crossbow, decision to the releasing of a trigger.
Ah, so the physical device there being so familiar by the point of Sun Tzu's writing that it's a proper source of metaphor.
Yeah, yeah. It's kind of like, this is not what he's talking about, but it's kind of like you can imagine someone saying, hey, when it comes to slinging insults, do you want to be an archer or a crossbow wielder? You know, be a crossbow wielder. Think up that insult in advance. Store it away. Store its potential away. And then when the time comes, you pull the trigger. Now, one source that we often come back to when we discuss technology and innovation and invention in ancient China is, of course, the work of Joseph Needham's, particularly his Science and Civilization in China series, which, gosh, off the top of my head, I can't remember how many volumes are in this series. Anytime I read it, I always get excited about it, and I'll take a moment to see if I can just buy them all, and then I quickly realize that I cannot do that. they're not necessarily in print, and there are a bunch of them.
If I'm not mistaken, though, Joseph Needham was the original author, the Science and Civilization in China series has sort of continued after his death, right?
That's right. And then also some volumes have been somewhat abbreviated because they are by other authors. They're pretty extensive, but I've always found them to be very readable and enjoyable. And his mastery and the mastery of those he was working with, not only historically, but linguistically, is just awe-inspiring. But one thing that he points out, I'm going to mention a few things that he mentions about the crossbow in these books. He writes, quote, it has been demonstrated that in ancient times in China, the progress of invention in offensive weapons, especially the efficient crossbow, far outstripped progress in defensive armor. This, he points out, is reflected in various accounts of feudal lords in ancient China being overtaken by peasants armed with crossbows. So this is just like another case of like a very broad generality that you can make about the crossbow in that it democratizes the use of the bow weapon. You don't have to be an expert archer to wield it. And especially if, like Needham was writing here, if defensive innovation is lagging behind offensive innovation, you may have the upper hand.
Mm.
Now, there wasn't just one Chinese crossbow, and I think in the next episode I'll talk about a specific innovation, but there were multiple innovations of the crossbow. And Needham discusses that one of the standard Chinese crossbows would be loaded by either lying on your back or standing on the bow, using leg thrusts and arms to cock the bow. Now, another thing he points out concerns gunpowder. We did a an episode or episodes about the invention of gunpowder. And we talked a bit in that about Chinese innovations concerning gunpowder, even in an offensive capacity. And he points out that, yeah, crossbows were also used with various incendiary implements, flammable or explosive crossbow bolts, etc. On the other hand, sometimes crossbow was used in the naming of a pyrotechnic ranged weapon, even if it was not actually a crossbow. He brings up the example of the fire crossbow meteoric arrow shooter. That's like the literal translation of the Chinese here. He points out it's not, as the name implies, a crossbow. It's also not, as the name implies, a rocket. He describes it as a, quote, proto-gun firing 10 poisoned arrows at a time, which came out, quote, like a flock of locusts.
Ooh.
So still kind of hard to imagine what that is, but apparently not an actual crossbow. But it's like, again, the technology is along so long, it becomes a metaphor. It also becomes a way of thinking about subsequent innovations and discoveries. But on the crossbow itself, he writes that, quote, China of the Warring States period, 5th century BCE, was almost certainly the home of the crossbow. And by the time that this became the standard weapon of the Han armies, it had acquired a bronze trigger mechanism of beautiful and intricate construction. The crossbow was introduced to the Western world probably twice, before the 5th century and again during the 10th century. He also contends that in this, the trigger as we know it extends from Chinese technological origins. So the trigger as something that would be used to fire guns, but then also we can take that even further and just think about like the use of a trigger again as a technological metaphor.
Right. Well, I mean, there are tons of inventions that are not weapons that have like elastic potential stored in some way, and there's a trigger lock holding it in place that can be released.
All right. Well, we're going to go ahead and close out this episode, but we will be back with more discussions of the crossbow, the invention of the crossbow. We want to get more into early examples of crossbows in Western traditions and Mediterranean traditions specifically. Also, there are a couple of key innovations I want to touch on from either the Middle East or, again, Chinese crossbow innovation of later years. And in the meantime, yes, if you have any personal experience with crossbows you'd like to chime in about, or with the bow, we did a good bit of discussion there about the bow, or if you just have experience in the imagined worlds of Dungeons and Dragons and other games concerning the use of a crossbow, well, that's fair game as well. Just a reminder that Stuff to Blow Your Mind is primarily a science podcast with core episodes on Tuesdays and Thursdays. On Mondays, we do listener mail. On Wednesdays, we usually have an artifact or monster fact episode. And then on Fridays, we set aside most serious concerns to just talk about a weird movie on Weird House Cinema.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, JJ Posway. If you would like to get in touch with us with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit visible.com.
Rev up your thrills this summer at Cedar Point on the all-new Top Thrill 2. Drive the sky on the world's tallest and fastest triple-launch vertical speedway. And now, for a limited time, get more Cedar Point fun for less with our limited-time bundle for just $49.99. Get admission, parking, and all-day drinks for one low price. But you better hurry, because this bundle won't last long. Save now at cedarpoint.com.
This is Malcolm Gladwell
from revisionist history. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.